From the National Humanities Center, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings, conversations featuring scholars and visitors at the National Humanities Center. Welcome to Soundings, aspects of contemporary women's studies, history, literature, and anthropology. Those are the topics this week on Soundings. My guests are Myra Jalen of Rutgers University and Ernestine Friedel, a visiting professor at Princeton University. First on this edition of Soundings, a discussion with Myra Jalen about women and the writing of history and literature, followed by a conversation with Ernestine Friedel about women and anthropology. According to Myra Jalen, much contemporary historical and literary scholarship about women is paradoxical. This stems from what Myra Jalen describes as an alienation in which feminist writers are torn between critical comment and ideological opposition. I asked Myra Jalen to explain why there should be feminist approaches to history and literature.
Well, there should be a feminist approach because there are women in the world, and because that has not been recognized as something to be taken into consideration when one tries to analyze the world in which we live. In fact, for me, and let me say this perhaps right at the start, for me, a feminist approach is not so much a set of statements. It's not about asserting certain things about women. It's not about saying that women are nicer than they've been thought to be. It's not about saying that women are smarter or stronger or taller. It's about identifying a problem. It's about raising a set of questions which no one or few people before have recognized as questions. Mm-hmm. It's about saying that the things that were taken for granted, which had to do with women and which were simply worked into analyses as if there were no issue about them, are in fact deeply problematical, and not only deeply problematical in themselves, but change the way we need to understand the problem in general that we're addressing.
All right. Now, you have written about what you call, the terms are not original to you, but I think they're very useful for our discussion here about feminist history and literary scholarship. The two words are the content of history and the shape of history.
Right.
What do you have in mind? And be anecdotal for me. Recall for me, for instance, the example of George Washington crossing the Delaware. What do you have in mind?
Well, okay. What I just was saying before, that feminism for me is much more about raising issues, about asking different questions, and about identifying a problem than it is any necessary set of answers or solutions to those problems, is also a distinction between content and form. That is, I'm debating, of course I think we need ideals. I'm actually suggesting that the ideal that is expressed in the centrality of George Washington in the middle of the Delaware is not a good ideal.
Okay.
I'm really questioning that ideal. I'm saying that it is an ideal which tends to suppress the roles of others who also participated in that. And, you know, if we talk about George Washington, we can talk about it very specifically. There were soldiers, first of all, common soldiers who participated with him. There were the wives and the women left back home. And we shouldn't forget what is absolutely invisible in that painting of George Washington crossing the Delaware, which is the presence of black slaves who were working plantations back home, and some of them belonging to George Washington himself. Now, an ideal which has the effect of rendering invisible that whole set of categories of other people is an ideal that I personally would not want to uphold and that I think really needs to be questioned.
All right, Myra Jalen, we're talking about the doing of history from a feminist perspective. How did this happen? Should we point a finger at what a school, quote unquote, of historiography, or a kind of what is this, a macho mindset, or you know, who's to blame? How did this happen? How did we come to this point?
Actually, I think that that's a very very interesting question, because I think we have come to this point in a corporate way. That is, I firmly believe that we don't think of things simply out of some transcendent impulse, that we think that which is thinkable in the time in which we think it. Mm-hmm. One of the
things... I might accuse you of some circularity there, but help me with this.
Yes, it is circular, but it's not. But it's circular in a way which draws the circle around our capabilities. That is, the notion that an individual is a transcendent, entirely self-created, totally, potentially free figure is associated with the idea also that thinking is of that kind. That is, that we don't think in a context, but that we are able to transcend our context.
You remind me, for example, of the phrase, we the people.
I think that as it has become increasingly apparent that that's not the case, that there are really important differences between groups of people, that there are important differences between nations, that there are important differences between continents. And then,
all right, now these haven't been necessarily left out of the doing of history. I mean, you wouldn't use a strong word like conspiracy, would you? Or would you?
No. In fact, the thing about conspiracy as a concept is I personally find it very uninteresting. Uh-huh. That is, I don't think that there has been a conspiracy.
It's just not
to
productive.
Repress. Well, and also it implies, in some ways, it implies that which I want to question.
Uh-huh.
It implies, if one says that there has been a conspiracy to oppress women, for instance, it implies that indeed there is somewhere a real corporate we, a corporate I, George Washington, who has the power to do this. No, what we're really talking about are ways in which society is organized that are within limits in the control of individuals, within larger limits in the controls of groups, but probably ultimately not in the control of anybody.
All right. Now, by way of explaining this, again, Myra Jalin, you come to the Humanities Center from Rutgers University, and our topic is the doing of history from a feminist perspective. Why did the women let this happen? How did they let the men get away with it? Is that a sort of historically absurd question to ask, or is it the kind of thing that you look into?
Well, it's not a historical question. I mean, it's not an absurd question, but it's not a historical question either. That is, I don't know that people let things happen to them. I think that when it becomes imaginable that the world be different from the way in which one experiences,
then it's going to change.
Then it's going to change.
Right.
Before that, if you imagine a world in transition, rather in the direction of the kind of individualism that we've been describing, mm-hmm. then it's a world in which people are leaving their traditional places, in many cases moving to cities, moving into different relations with others, even if they're not changing their place geographically. And their energies and their thoughts are bent on what most energies and mm-hmm. thoughts are bent, which is survival.
All right, now, this is a little depressing, Myra Jalin, to hear you tell me that I remember as an undergraduate reading the novels of Thomas Hardy, and the professor said, here we have all these characters who are caught up in this utterly indifferent naturalistic world, forces beyond your control. Sounds like what you're telling me here is happening to men and women in history. What happened to free agency? What happened to our ability to sort of counteract what you scholars call the forces of history?
I think it's not we're not talking now about a naturalistic universe, but about a historical universe.
Uh-huh.
But nonetheless, your question is absolutely the right one. I would want to argue that abandoning what is a myth of absolute free agency mm-hmm. is the beginning of developing much greater control over our lives than we've had in the past.
Now, that's a wonderful paradox. We surrender some freedom in order to gain some others.
Because, in fact, the reason for that, well, it may be that all of life is paradoxical, but I think the reason for that is that when we operate with the myth of total freedom, and when we imagine that we constantly rebuild the world, in Emersonian terms, we build ourselves our own world every morning of our lives.
That's very comforting, though, in a way.
Well, it may be comforting. Exactly. It may be comforting.
Illusory.
I don't think it's empowering.
Yeah.
That is, I think that there's a great difference there between uh-huh. An illusion which makes us feel very comfortable and cheers us as we go about our lives, and a way of understanding those lives that may indeed give us much greater power in them. Fact is that if one thinks about the way one lives every day, it isn't out of an absolute freedom. Yeah. We negotiate, we mediate, we do what we can with everything that's, we push against limits which are really very, very close. Mm-hmm. Our noses press against them. But if we see that as indeed the way in which we normally function, then first of all, to recognize that that's the nature of freedom. That's been the nature that, of freedom that we've experienced all our lives. I think simply through the recognition gives us a kind of power. Yeah. We say, ah, well, then, if indeed what I can do is this amount, then I can do this amount.
Sort of pushing the borders.
That's right. And the other thing also is I think that the illusion of absolute freedom, to put it another way, the illusion which many people in our society operate with, which is that, or are told that they should operate with, which is that if they really try very hard and are very good, they can make anything happen, can be an utterly discouraging notion because it's not true. Yeah. And the kinds of failure that one then feels one is incurring are paralyzing.
Mm-hmm. Myra Jalin, let's conclude our conversation. You are a scholar of literature and history from Rutgers University. You're at the Humanities Center working on this wonderful title. I have to ask you about this, Archimedes and the Paradox of Feminist Criticism. Give me a couple of minutes about that. What are you doing?
First of all, let me say that the Archimedes of that title is not the Archimedes of the bathtub. I realized only after I gave her the title that there are people who imagine Archimedes soaking in the tub and can't quite see what that would have to do with
this is the one who said, give me a place to stand on and I'll move the universe.
That's right.
Help me with it. Do I paraphrase
if
that?
If I can, well, he said if I could have some place off the earth to place the fulcrum of my lever, I could lift the earth.
Uh-huh.
Okay. Now, what that is for me is a wonderful image of the problem of thinking about the most basic issues of our society.
And this goes back to the series of paradoxes that you've been outlining with respect to feminism and history.
Exactly. And it points to a very fundamental paradox among those, which is that assumptions about the nature of gender are absolutely basic to all of our thinking. So that in a way, what we find ourselves having to do is to think about the things we think with.
Emerson said, tell me your sect and I shall anticipate your argument.
And he was absolutely right. Yeah. He was absolutely right. So here we are, on the other hand, with no possibility of a place off the earth on which to put our fulcrum. Let me give you an example. This is a familiar author. Let me talk a little bit about Hemingway. In Hemingway's novels, I would say in all of them, there is a recurrent theme, which is the problem for a man in defining himself as a powerful figure in the world. And the way in which he goes about defining that is quite often, first, in sexual terms.
Mm-hmm.
It's his virility, and indeed, virility is a word that applies, that begins in a conception of sexuality and extends to a conception of social and general power. That is, that the way in which a man defines himself is by undefining or by redefining in his own terms another person who is a woman.
So it's not the problem of the perception or the prejudice or the inclination of the author. It is the problem of what exists in the material that the author's drawing
exactly.
on.
Exactly. That's why in this the way in which it comes back to that paradox of the Archimedean paradox, because the problem lies in the material, in the language. And by language here, I just don't mean a set of words, of course. I mean the whole cultural baggage that we bring with us every time we want to speak or say or think.
Mm-hmm.
It is there in the very structures of our thinking so that certain kinds of identity are literally unimaginable. They would contradict our language for women under certain assumptions.
Mm-hmm.
And it's these assumptions that we are needing to question now, I think.
Myra Jalin is a professor of English at Rutgers University. The program is Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. During a recent fellowship year at the center, Myra Jalin worked on a forthcoming book entitled Archimedes and the Paradox of Feminist Criticism. Soundings on Contemporary Women's Studies continues now with an excerpt from a conversation with Ernestine Friedel, who is currently a visiting professor at Princeton University. Before that, she taught at Duke University, where she also served as Dean of the College of Arts and Sciences. During her recent fellowship year at the National Humanities Center, Ernestine Friedel worked on a forthcoming book about women and anthropology. Here is Ernestine Friedel.
We're talking about functions, if you like, tasks. What is it that women do in the world? Mm-hmm. And that's very important, because women do much more than bear children and raise children in all societies. There's no place in the entire world where any woman does nothing but raise children or bear children. Mm-hmm. Obviously, there's other work involved. Now, the great question, the interesting question, is what other work do women do?
Mm-hmm. And why is it important?
And why? Well, it's of course important, because any work anybody does is important.
Uh-huh.
So, but the question is, what is it that they do in contrast to men? And in some societies, of course, women do a great deal of work that actually produces food.
Mm-hmm.
Among hunters and gatherers, the women gather food, so they are really producing as well as reproducing.
And are you saying that this has been unacknowledged or uninvestigated from the anthropological standpoint?
It has been uninvestigated to the extent that there hasn't been sufficient concentration on what the consequences of women's activities, apart from childbearing and child-rearing, have been in a society. For example, among the Navajo, it was anthropologists who did discover, some of them women, who did discover that the women owned the sheep, and that the women very often controlled the killing of the sheep and how many sheep the family was going to try to sustain. When the American Indian Service came into the Navajo country and wanted to cut down the size of the sheep herd,
They went to the men. Yeah.
And by going to the men and having meetings only with the men, they didn't get very far.
Uh-huh.
But they didn't know or understand that. So there has been a recognition of it among some, recognition of the importance of what women do in many in previous studies.
Mm-hmm.
But there has never been this a concentration on it with a concern with the importance of what women do, but a concern with how child rearing is adjusted to what women do.
Mm-hmm.
Our assumption is that what you have to do is adjust work to child rearing. I believe that what really happens is that one adjusts child rearing to the kind of work that women are doing.
Mm-hmm. And that's a relatively fresh perspective.
And that's a fresh perspective, and I think it's a new one, and it's one that I want to emphasize a great deal more than I did in the first book that I did.
Uh-huh.
For example, I can say a word about Greek women, because I've done field work in modern Greece.
Mm-hmm.
And because women have to provide a dowry, or their fathers have to provide a dowry for them to get married, there is a very strong feeling that the dowry is demeaning to women, because they view themselves, and some of the modern women's movements have viewed this whole dowry system as one in which the woman is not wanted for herself, but is wanted for her property, and that is therefore demeaning to the woman as a human being and as a personality.
Now, the Greek women themselves
view
this.
Some of the Greek women view it this way.
Okay.
Certainly, the sophisticated Greek women view it this way. The uneducated Greek women may not think of it that way.
Mm-hmm.
They may just not consider it the custom without a lot of examination of it, although they also have some sense of its, slight sense of its demeaning quality. Well, that's one way of looking at it. This is the way in which some people can see it. But there is the other side of it, which is that the bringing property into a marriage gives the woman some kind of leverage, and therefore gives her a degree of leverage in the actual practical life of the marriage. Whether the property that she brings in is an apartment, as it is these days, or whether it, as it used to be, land and animals, and it gives her some leverage, some sort of economic power within the organization of the marriage.
Mm-hmm.
Now that is expressed only privately because publicly the men are the ones who make all the decisions, and the men are the people who are important, and the men are the ones who have the power. But privately, a lot of women can exercise a considerable amount of influence.
Well, the revenge of the women is marriage.
Yes.
Can we say that?
One could argue that. So my point is that the statements that people make about what they are doing and how they understand it is one level of understanding that every anthropologist has to get.
Uh-huh.
The second level is to see what it looks like from an outsider's point of view, even if that outsider also is wearing the glasses of his or her own culture.
Mm-hmm.
But nevertheless, it's a different view.
Is this project, you're investigating women in anthropology, mm-hmm. Ernestine Friedel, is this a sort of activist kind of thing? What exactly do you intend to accomplish? I mean, obviously you're writing for other anthropologists, but my guess is that you would also want to take this to a sort of wider circle.
Mm-hmm.
Tell me about that.
What I'd like to accomplish is to make it evident
mm-hmm.
to anybody who reads this work that there is enormous variety in what women's activities are and what significance they have for the total running of a society,
mm-hmm.
political, economic, social organization of a society, that there is enormous variation in how people think about women. And about sex, of course, too, and whether women are viewed as very sexual, which is one common view, so enamored of sex that they will ensnare any man, and therefore men must control them completely
mm-hmm.
in order to prevent them from ruining men.
That's the men's revenge.
Yeah, and that's a common, certainly a very common point of view. The
mm-hmm.
other, which is a little bit perhaps closer to what we believe, which is that men are sexually very active and really can't quite control themselves. You expect them to be sexual beings, and therefore the women have to restrain the men.
Mm-hmm.
And therefore it's always the woman's fault if there are problems, because it's the woman hasn't exercised her function of restraining the man.
Ernestine Friedel, our topic is women in anthropology. Are American women the most liberated? Are they as liberated as any other society in the world? Or is that just given all of the factors that enter into the mix, is that an impossible question?
I think it is probably an impossible question, because the issue is not trying to rate the liberation of women on a scale
right.
of 1 to 10 and where did people fit. Rather, what you need to look at is what are the fields, the domains, the situations in which women are liberated
mm-hmm.
and which are the domains in which they're not liberated.
Okay, and in your view, what would be the most important of these domains? Money? Is that it? Or who runs the household?
That's part of what you need the research for,
uh-huh.
to find out which one of these domains or what combination of them actually affects
uh-huh.
the extent of liberation in various fields. For example, women are now, American women, one can argue, are to some extent more liberated in the sense that many more occupations have been opened to them, particularly
yeah.
executive occupations of various kinds, but only, of course, to a very small proportion of women in
mm-hmm.
the United States. And even though these occupations have been opened to them, there are other ways in which they are having an even harder time. Because as they are in these occupations, and as men feel freer to leave women and not to support women, which is legitimate given the interest of women in their ability to take care of themselves,
mm-hmm.
women are then left with the need to take care of the entire household and to raise children. They do a double job, and while the men still continue to do the same job. So we have liberation on the one hand, and non-liberation, as it were, on the other.
Mm-hmm. Ernie Friedel, our topic is women in anthropology. Speculate on this for me. As you look at the roster of strengths and weaknesses, equities and inequities in gender relationships in American society, or by whatever other example you might care to cite, are these problems what the social scientists call structural? Or do they come back to human nature in the sense that the men are looking at the women and saying, no way, we're not going to surrender the power. If you want it, you're going to have to come and get it. That's on the one side of the table. On the other side of the table is, that's just, you know, Alexander Pope, whatever is right. That's the way it's always happened. Mm-hmm. That's the way we'll continue.
I think there is a structural basis, as they say, for all of this, certainly, and that's one of the things that I'm trying to find out about. Mm-hmm. I also think that there is a strong set of beliefs and values, which I was talking about, too, about how men feel about the women and their sense of traditional sense of superiority over women.
But my question is, where do these structures come from? I mean, structures don't appear in textbooks. They come out of human behavior. And human behavior comes out of the way men treat women and vice versa.
Yes, but
help me to figure these things
out.
Yes,
but human nature is not human nature in the sense of it's some sort of original nature that all human beings have. Human nature is constructed.
We create it.
We create it.
Right.
We create it by the culture and the society that we're in.
Okay.
And when I talk about religious beliefs and practices and economic circumstances and developments of historical developments in economics and politics, I am talking about the elements which create human nature.
Mm-hmm.
The ancient Romans didn't have the same human nature. Men didn't view women or think about women in the same terms as we do.
Mm-hmm.
Now, obviously, then there's not a nature there.
So when we get down to these specifics about the way we look at money, the way we look at sex or religion or cultural elements, we are really very lucky. We have, to sound rather Pollyanna-ish about it, we have an opportunity to recreate these structures. Why don't we?
Oh, we've done a lot.
Okay.
we've still got a long way to go, but we've certainly done some. We've certainly reached the point where people are aware of the disabilities that women have been under in our own culture, certainly, and have done something to try to correct them. The American emphasis on youth, for example, and on looking and appearing youthful, the assumption being that there's something wrong with you if you no longer look young. My own view is that the only human beings I've ever known who didn't change and who kept on looking very young were also people who had never understood anything that happened to them in their lives. They were totally insensitive and never suffered. And if you've never suffered and never understood what was happening to you in the course of your life and never had any kind of strong emotions, then of course your face doesn't change and you stay youthful. Or you can have a nice smooth expression and be almost like a baby. And I've seen people like that.
Mm-hmm.
Everyone says, oh, they still look so young. But of course, they look so young because they're not very bright.
So it isn't time. It isn't time that does us in. It's experience.
It's experience, and as well as time.
Uh-huh.
But experience, what to show, seems to me. And there's nothing wrong with its showing.
Ernestine Friedel is a visiting professor at Princeton University. During a recent fellowship year at the National Humanities Center, Ernestine Friedel worked on a forthcoming book about women and anthropology. The program is Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. For a cassette copy of Soundings on Contemporary Women's Studies, send $3 to the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. Next week on Soundings, a discussion about interpreting the American Constitution. My guests will be William Luchtenberg of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, and Edwin Yoder, Jr., a syndicated columnist who writes for the Washington Post Writers Group. Until next week, this is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Support for Soundings comes from the National Endowment for the Humanities.
Listen to Soundings. This is Kim Nielsen at the National Humanities Center, inviting you to join Wayne Pond this week for discussions about several aspects of contemporary women's studies, history, literature, and anthropology. What is the paradox of feminist criticism? How are the functions and roles of women in the modern world changing? Some answers and insights from scholars from Rutgers and Princeton universities. Contemporary Women's Studies, the topic this week on Soundings, from the National Humanities Center on this station.